The Madhouse Chicago Hockey Podcast is brought to you by Triple Threat Sports. For all your team outfitting needs, call Chris at 708-478-6090. The Black Oak in Oaklawn, the South Suburbs' finest casual upscale dining. And Marishka's in Crest Hill, family owned and operated since 1933. Let's drop the postseason puck.
Welcome to the Madhouse Chicago Hockey Podcast with NBCChicago.com's James Naveau.
It's not even so much me as it's Ronick. He's good.
And 670 The Score's hockey guy, Jay Zawoski.
You don't play this game with a big heart and a big bag of knuckles in front of the net. You don't got dinky-doo.
Welcome into the first in-postseason edition of the Madhouse Chicago Hockey Podcast. My name is James Naveau from NBC5 Chicago and The Athletic Chicago. With me, as always, only in spirit this time, not in person, unfortunately, the one, the only, the ready for the weekend, Jay Zawoski. Jay, what a week it has been. How are you preparing to spend your next 2 days?
There is a pizza order going into Aurelio's right now, and as soon as we're done with this podcast, I'll be stuffing my face full of it and then enjoying the warm weather. Tomorrow I have my event with Albert Almora at Sports Corner after the Cubs game. So if you're at the Cubs game tomorrow, that would be Saturday the 15th. Stop by Sports Corner and come meet Albert Almora and me. I'll also be there, but no one will care.
I have tickets to the game,
and I have tickets to the game. I invited you to come, and you have to work like some kind of sucker.
Yep, like some kind of adult. I have to work. Yeah, it's that time of year where usually I'm off on Fridays and Saturdays. Like, those are my days off now that I'm Mr., you know, important full-time guy at NBC. But unfortunately, with the Blackhawks playing tomorrow, I don't exactly get the option to be off of work. So I do have to go into the office tomorrow. And to make it even better, after about 6:30, I'm going to be by myself for the first time on the web desk. So if the Pope decides that gay marriage is okay tomorrow night, guess what? I get to write about it.
I would doubt that's going to happen on Easter Eve. He's got some other things going on, so look for that another day. I don't think it'll be tomorrow. Anyway, more important things to get to. The Blackhawks, they lost 1-0 last night. And, you know, I'm not going to – I want to say one thing. I'm very pleased at the lack of panic that I've seen from the Hawks fans. In years past, the Hawks would get down at one game and people would start to freak out. I have not seen very much of that. Have you?
I really haven't, no. Like, I kind of went over to the sports desk last night while the game was going on, and I just kind of was asking the producers, I was like, is there really anything that the Blackhawks, like, need to change? Like, is there, like, anything that they're doing, like, particularly wrong? And the answer, it seemed like, was no, just kind of keep doing what you're doing, and eventually the goals are going to come, because the way Nashville played last night, like, if they play like that the rest of the series, the Blackhawks are going to win, because you can't keep playing that protection style and expect it to work. So I think a lot of Blackhawks fans, and I was maybe a little bit surprised by this, because I think, like, as a fan, your default reaction is always to be like, oh God, they didn't score, we're all doomed, yada yada. That did not seem to be the default reaction of Blackhawks fans last night, and I have to give them a good amount of credit for really keeping their heads about them and keeping their wits about them. I was really impressed.
Well, I think watching that game, and aside from the really lame start the Blackhawks had, it was pretty clear to see that they were the better team. I would say the first 5 minutes the Hawks had the edge. Then Nashville scored, carried it on to the end of the first period, and then the second and third, especially the second, was all Blackhawks, and yeah, they weren't able to put the puck in the net. Those sort of things happen, and we've talked about this all the time, how hockey's a game of inches, and a bounce here or a deflection there can be the difference between winning and losing, and I think that was sort of the case last night. I would like to see them generate a few more high-danger scoring chances. They only had 8 last night. Nashville had 7, and they were playing to prevent most of the game, so I'd like to see the Hawks get some more dangerous scoring chances, but all in all, they were the better team. They deserved to win. They won in all the possession numbers. They won in shots. They won in shots on goal, shot attempts. They won in faceoffs. So pretty much every category except the final score, the Blackhawks led in. So to me, that's encouraging. It was a little bit more of another lackadaisical playoff start like we've seen from the Hawks over the last few years. But nothing I saw last night tells me that the Nashville Predators are better than the Blackhawks. I just don't see it.
Well, I mean, I think we could both agree that going into this series, we kind of knew that it was going to be closely matched, right? Like, we kind of knew that Nashville, yeah, they were the fourth seed in the Central Division, but in reality, they're a very solid hockey team. They're a very deep hockey team. I feel like a lot of times people kind of get distracted by some of the star power names, like guys like PK Subban, guys like Philip Forsberg, guys like James Neal, Pekka Rinne. They kind of look at those guys and they kind of ignore the fact that they've got some really good complementary players. You know, if you can be a complementary player, I guess you should say, when you score, I think, 31 goals like Victor Arvidsson did. But he, honestly, like, that guy is a revelation for the Predators. Like, I don't think anybody saw him coming into the league and doing what he's doing. And that goal that he had last night, he really took advantage of, I think, a miscue by Duncan Keith, who kind of got, like, entranced by the puck a little bit and pulled up into the slot a little bit. And it allowed Victor Arvidsson just a wide-open lane to get in front of the net and pull off a really nifty deflection on a shot from Philip Forsberg. That, to me, was a designed play, and they took advantage of a breakdown by the Blackhawks defense. And honestly, all credit to Nashville for being able to do stuff like that.
Yeah, it was a hell of a play. And it's funny, you know, Arvidsson, a very similar story to Richard Panik, you know, a guy who has a lot of skill but spent most of his career kind of bouncing up and down. When he was up, he was all over the lines, not getting a ton of minutes. When he finally was given his opportunity to contribute, he was able to put up, what, 31 goals this year, including being their best player on the ice last night. That's a really nice player. And it goes to show you that sometimes all these prospects need is a chance to thrive. And he got it. Richard Panik got it for the Blackhawks. And you see two guys who were, I don't think Arvidsson was as written off as Panik was, but you see a guy emerge with a chance, and sometimes that's all it takes. But yeah, they are a good team. You're right. And there is a chance they could win this series for sure. Hell, I picked them to win the Stanley Cup early on in the season. They got off to a slow start. The Hawks were better than I expected, so I changed my pick during the playoffs. But I think the Nashville Predators pose the toughest challenge to the Blackhawks in the Western Conference. I really do. Matchup-wise, personnel-wise, I think once the Hawks, or if the Hawks, are able to get past Nashville, they're going to have an easier path with St. Louis or Minnesota, and whoever comes out west. I think the Hawks are facing their toughest task right now.
And do you think that's a good thing for them, being the last couple of playoffs? It's really seemed like they've kind of gotten off to a sluggish start. Do you think it's a good thing for them that they're kind of facing this, like, tough opposition early on, instead of having to kind of wait until later in the playoffs, as you saw in, say, 2013, 2014, when they had to wait until the conference final to get their first real test against a team like the Los Angeles Kings? Do you think that benefits them?
It certainly could. I mean, I think last night's game, in fact, can kind of benefit them. I read Barry Rosner's column this morning saying how the locker rooms were, you know, the Predators were celebrating and the Hawks room was very quiet. And to me, that indicates that they're a pissed off team and they feel like one got away. And the earlier that wake up call can come for a team that is known to coast sort of early on in the playoffs, I think it could be a good thing. So I don't want to say I'm happy they lost, but to get this one out of the way and to get that sluggish start out of the way, I think it can get them sort of an extra jump in their step. And one thing I notice, and I don't know if it's just because we watch Hawks games differently than we watch other playoff games, but the Hawks games never seem to have the intensity of the other games I'm watching, where, you know, the puck drops and both teams are playing incredibly physically, fast-paced, and maybe it's the Hawks' experience, maybe it's the fact that they know that they can control things if they just play their game, but it doesn't seem to have the intensity or the speed that other games have. And I'm not talking about hitting or fighting or anything like that. I just mean the overall sort of reckless abandon of playoff hockey. You don't really see that when the Blackhawks are on the ice.
I think you noticed it kind of last night that Joel Quenneville is recognizing that that's the kind of game the Blackhawks are going to have to play, is that fast-paced game that you're talking about that they don't usually deploy. I think you saw that last night because the Blackhawks, very early in the game, moved away from having John Hayden and Jordan Tutu on the ice. I think they both ended up with like a little bit more than 5 minutes of ice time. And there really weren't that many power plays that would kind of justify that. So I think Joel Quenneville recognized immediately that the Blackhawks' best chance in this series is to be to kind of have a quicker pace. And I think you noticed it at times last night, especially in the second period, I think you noticed it, where the Blackhawks really were pushing the tempo. They were trying a lot of stretch passes last night. It really looked like the defensemen were trying to activate. I personally thought Trevor Van Riemsdyk maybe had one of his best games of the season last night. I really liked what he was doing. What did you think about his performance?
Yeah, I thought he was fine. I didn't see anything that was outstanding or poor. I think that what you want from a guy at that point on your roster is to just go out there and not hurt things. And I did see that from him. What I have liked about him, though, probably from the last third of the season, is that he's been a little more willing to activate offensively. And that shows me that he's playing with a lot more confidence. He's not playing to not make mistakes. And I think you could say this with pretty much any hockey player, and you sort of said it with the Predators. If you play not to lose, you're probably going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that Van Riemsdyk, I feel, has been a better defenseman since he's become more aggressive.
And I think the key, too, is you always want to see that aggression balanced out with common sense and awareness. And I think what we've seen from Van Riemsdyk in the past is when he has done that, when he's kind of started to get the offensive push going, he hasn't really done it in situations where he's not going to get burned defensively. It seems like lately that aggression has been very controlled. He's been very adamant about making sure that he's got coverage on the back end, whether it's from another forward pulling back or whether it's Brian Campbell skating over to provide coverage. I've definitely noticed more of an awareness to Trevor Van Riemsdyk's game in the last few weeks, I think. And you saw that again last night. He didn't give Nashville any like big opportunities to make huge jumps up the ice to take advantage of him pinching in. And I feel like that smart aggressiveness is what you want out of Trevor Van Riemsdyk. And if you can get that out of a third-pairing defenseman, I think in the long term that's a really good thing. So I think that's a great sign for the Blackhawks that Trevor Van Riemsdyk was able to do what he was doing last night.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And with, you know, minutes and with time on ice and just by playing with veteran players like Brian Campbell, who was not great last night. We'll get into that a little bit later. But just as he's been, you know, he's been trusted in some big moments in his career. And we're looking right now, he's played 158 career games. This is when a young defenseman should start to show a little bit of maturity about, you know, this is pretty much the mark of 2 years for him. So he should be maturing. He should be getting better. And he is. So I'm encouraged by that. I'm still not quite as in love with him as Quenneville is.
Well, who is?
But I don't know who is. But I have liked what I've seen. And, you know, me and you were two of his harshest critics early in the year, but he's certainly improved, certainly gotten better. Before we move on to our thoughts about the pairings and about the lines, I want to tell you all about Marishka's Restaurant, one of our fine sponsors, 604 Theodore Street in Crest Hill, just west of Route 53, 815-723-9371. Family-owned and operated at the same location since 1933. They offer hand-cut products in their own butcher shop, including their steaks, burgers, and the famous Poor Boy Sandwich, the greatest thing you will ever devour in your life. They serve the highest quality steak, seafood, and chops, and numerous homemade items made fresh in-house, including their onion rings and the double-baked potatoes, the Icelandic cod. Today is Good Friday. If you're listening on Friday, probably the last day, well, I guess it is the last day for that Lenten special of the Icelandic cod and the amazing macaroni and cheese. Just a great meal at Marishka's, so go there today. They've got a full carryout menu, a bar with craft beer, and banquet facilities for groups of up to 110 people. So visit Marishka's.com or check them out on Facebook at Facebook.com/Marishka's. That's M-E-R-I-C-H-K-A-S. They're open 7 days a week and close only on Christmas, Easter, the 4th of July, and Thanksgiving. So a rare day off for Marishka's coming up on Sunday, and a well-earned day off, I might add.
I would absolutely agree with that. You said you wanted to kind of get into the pairings a little bit. If you'll indulge me, I want to get your take first and foremost since we're going to go down this path. What did you think of the decision to drop Nick Schmaltz in the lineup last night and bump Tanner Caro up? I think I mentioned on Twitter that I understood the logic behind the decision, and obviously Tanner Caro looked absolutely fantastic last night on that top line. The thing I worry about is that I think long term, in order for that top line to be at its most effective, I really feel like you have to have Nick Schmaltz up there. And if you're not going to, you're not going to be able to get fourth line minutes out of him. That's not his game. So he basically has to be on that top line, or I would just as soon put a guy like Dennis Rasmussen or somebody, or Andrew Desjardins if he's assuming healthy, obviously. But I would probably put a guy like that into the lineup over Schmaltz if you're not going to have him on that top line. What was your impression? What was your thought last night when Joel Quenneville made that decision in the second period?
First of all, I agree with you. If Nick Schmaltz is not going to play in the top six, there's probably no point in him being in the lineup. Today in practice, Hartman and Hayden were taking turns switching on that left wing on the top line, so it looks like Schmaltz might not be in the top six when game two rolls around on Saturday. At the moment, I sort of like the move. I think we saw more than anybody, really, Nick Schmaltz sort of struggling with the speed and this pace and the room of a playoff hockey game. It's the first time he's, you know, every old hockey player uses the cliche that the ice is smaller during the playoffs. There's not as much room to operate. Schmaltz is a guy that needs room to operate. Yes, he can create his own from time to time, but in the playoffs it's different, and I think you really saw him sort of struggle with the way the game was played last night. Not to mention, Nashville's playing a trap style most of the game anyway, with four guys standing at the blue line. It takes away a lot of creativity for a guy like Schmaltz. So with him struggling to sort of adapt to the pace of the game and to the style of the game, I didn't mind giving Caro a look up there. As soon as he went up there, things started sort of, you know, popping for that top line. They seemed to have their best success working behind the net and cycling behind the net. That's when they had the most possession, some of their best looks to score. And Caro's the sort of guy that can go back there, get down and dirty, free up some pucks, win some board battles. And for all of Nick Schmaltz's skill, that's not one of the things he does well. So when Schmaltz is on that line, it makes, you know, Taves becomes more of a guy who's going to have to go do some dirty work. With Caro doing it with Panic, that leaves Taves as sort of the top offensive option. So I see both sides of it, but I do think you're right. I think Schmaltz should stay in the lineup. And, of course, if he does, he needs to be in the top six. I think given another game to just sort of catch his breath, realize what's happening around him, I think he'll be fine. I'm not overly concerned. I got it at the time, but I would like to see, as the series goes on, him to stay in the top six.
Well, I think the only,
and technically the top three, I guess.
Sorry. The only way that I really think you're going to get used to the pace of a playoff game is to play in a playoff game. And Joel Quenneville, I think, only used Nick for about 4.5 minutes, I think, before he dropped him to the bottom six last night. Does that sound about right to you? I don't know if that's enough time. And I get completely what you're saying, that he needs more space to kind of do what he does. At the same time, what I would maybe like to see Joel do, and this is just a suggestion, based on the fact that their power play last night looked just god-awful. And it has for the last several games. I pointed out in my game preview.
Well, it helps in the power play when you move.
Exactly.
Just to say, like, move your feet.
And this is the point I'm driving at, is that they were 2 of their last 28 going into the playoffs on the power play. That's pretty damn bad. And they looked even worse than that last night. They looked like a team that hadn't scored on the power play in 2 weeks. They looked like a high school senior with acne issues trying to score on prom night. They just did not have any idea what they were doing. And I honestly feel like if you're going to keep Nick Schmaltz in this lineup, he needs to play a more prominent role on that power play when there is more space on the ice and when his quickness and when his hands are going to be worth the most. I would love to see him get extended looks on the power play if you're going to keep him in the lineup, because you have to do something. That power play, if it's going to produce like that, the Blackhawks are in huge trouble. They've got to take advantage when they've got that space on the ice, when Nashville can't just stack four guys at the blue line. They can't really do that when they're shorthanded. They've got to do something about that, and I think that might be where Nick Schmaltz finds his kind of in back into the lineup and back into the mix.
You're totally right. I mean, if you've got a guy you're going to limit at even strength that's going to be in the lineup, you've got to have him contributing where he can, and that is on the power play. You're absolutely right about that. I don't know. It's frustrating, and I'm trying to not fall into, like, the meatball trap. But there was so little urgency from the Blackhawks last night in so many aspects of the game. I get you've been there before. I get you've been through the wars. You've got all this experience. That's all fine and good. But teams are not going to wait for you to show up in the playoffs, okay? The first period, they were sleepwalking, refusing to adjust to the trap, just trying to carry. You're not going to skate through four defensemen at a blue line for a playoff team, for a Stanley Cup contender. It's not going to happen. It's just not. And I mean, there was a point during the power play, I believe it was in the third period, where Duncan Keith was in the neutral zone, just standing there with the puck. And everyone's just sort of waiting, like, is someone going to move forward with the puck? And again, I don't want to fall into this meatball zone, but really, anyone who watched that game, who's watched hockey in the past, I've not seen a good power play look like that.
Yeah.
Where the quarterback of the power play is standing still, waiting for guys to start to cycle behind him. Get moving. Move your feet. You've got the man advantage against a team that's trapping you. This is your chance to score. They're treating it like a 5-on-3 power play where they're looking for that one perfect shot. Playoff goals are not pretty. They're just not.
Never.
You've got to get the puck on net, have it hit someone in the butt, and go in. That's how it works. And I don't care how much skill they have and all that stuff. It's totally true, of course. But it's a different game in the playoffs, and they've got to show a willingness to do it, and they can't wait until it's too late to do it again. They waited last year until it was too late. They still almost overcame it, but they fell short. Had they woken up for game one, game two against the Blues, maybe they win the Stanley Cup again. They can't let these slow starts crush them like they did. And again, last night it was just a period. It wasn't a whole game or two games like it was last year.
Right.
So hopefully when game two starts on Saturday, they can get their asses moving a little bit and generating some offense with some urgency. It was a very, very frustrating game to watch last night.
Did you know who really made, I thought, some good adjustments going into the second period and the way that he was approaching zone entries and the way that he was approaching scoring opportunities? Was Artemi Panarin actually did some really interesting stuff last night. He was one of the few guys who kind of realized somewhat early in the game, and then more so as you kind of got into the flow of it in the second and third period, he realized that just carrying the puck into the zone wasn't going to cut it against Nashville, what they were doing in the neutral zone and in the defensive zone. He started dumping the puck in and going and getting it and creating scoring opportunities and possessions way earlier than it seemed like anybody else did. And for a second-year guy to be able to make that kind of an adjustment, and especially a guy that you and I have criticized a little bit for being kind of a one-trick pony, especially on the power play where he's just kind of waiting for the puck to get to him in the faceoff dot so he can rip off that one-timer, I felt like that was a very interesting wrinkle that he threw into his game last night, and he did it at both even strength and on the power play, and I kind of noticed on the power play especially, he was one of the few guys that was actually moving into kind of soft areas of the ice to kind of try to find room to work with, and it seemed like if everybody else had kind of taken his lead, they would have done a better job. I got to give Artemi Panarin credit. I thought he actually played a really smart game last night, even though the stat line may not necessarily reflect it. The eye test really did to me, and he was one of the few guys on offense that really stood out to me.
Well, there was another guy I thought had a pretty good game, but was clearly dealing with the rust of not playing in a month, and that's Artem Anisimov, who had a lot of chances that he just kind of couldn't figure out how to get. Because you could tell that, man, taking a month off of hockey is tough, especially coming back and starting to play in the playoffs. But the puck found him a lot, and he would either sort of, you know, heal it or whiff on it or whatever. I think the ice was pretty crappy last night, too, from what I can tell.
Oh, God, yes, it was awful.
Uncharacteristic, hopping over the blue line, hopping over sticks that we're not used to seeing from the Blackhawks or, quite frankly, the Predators. We saw it for both teams. So the United Center is known for its trash ice. Hopefully it wasn't a huge factor last night, but it seemed to be to me. There's a lot to unpack, and we could spend 4 hours discussing one playoff game. It's not really going to solve anything. Like we said when we started, I know we're sort of ranting here and getting pissed off about some of the small things that annoyed us last night, but I think, and I don't want to speak for you, but I still feel very good about their chances in this series and beyond. It's just there's some things that have become a trend over the last few playoff seasons that have become very frustrating and very hard to understand and explain.
I think our listeners are going to give us a little bit of credit here. I really don't feel like we're overreacting to anything. I don't really feel like we're like naysaying or, oh, we're so doomed or whatever. The things that I think we're pointing out are pretty obvious, easy strategic decisions to potentially make. I think we're just kind of laying out a roadmap for what we think comes next. I feel like we're, honestly, this is going to sound silly, so please pardon me as I say this. I feel like we're kind of approaching this like the players are, where game one happened. What can you learn from game one? Game two is next. We're just kind of matter-of-factly laying out strategic changes that they need to make, I don't feel like this is overreacting at all. I think we're on it. We're honestly doing what we, I guess, as a hockey podcaster, supposed to do. We're just kind of analyzing and moving forward. I don't feel like there's a lot of angry second guessing. I don't feel like there's a lot of meatballishness. Jay, I hate to tell you this. I feel like we're being a really responsible and smart hockey podcast right now. I don't know how feel about it.
What has happened to us?
Yeah, we changed, man. We sold out.
Where do we lose our way? It's those damn Scott Powers and Brian Hedger's influence.
Ooh, those guys rubbed off on us. That clearly is what happened.
Take it easy. Speak for yourself. It did not happen to me.
Hedger was getting handsy, as you guys all heard on the podcast.
He was pounding the table, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I have no good segue to Triple Threat Sports right now, so I'm just going to do it. Triple Threat Sports, as you know, is the best place in the area to get your NHL jerseys lettered. But did you know they're also the best place to go if your team needs jerseys? Whether you're an elite travel high school or college program that needs to outfit hundreds of kids, or if you're a beer and pizza league team with 12 players, Triple Threat can put you in pro-quality jerseys at pricing you can afford. Triple Threat Sports can work with you on every aspect of the job. Logo design, fitting, apparel for off-ice, you name it. And you don't have to be a hockey player to wear uniforms in Triple Threat. They can get uniforms and apparel for all sports. Baseball, softball, football, lacrosse, and more. So for more info, call Chris at 708-478-6090. That's 708-478-6090. Or email him for more info at chris@triplethreatsports.com. Triple Threat Sports, if you can wear it, they can make it. All right, now that we've done that, are you making any lineup changes in Game 2?
That's a tremendous question. But before we transition completely away from the Triple Threat Sports, the jersey thing, I just wanted to point out that I'm probably going to be playing 16-inch softball in Chicago this summer. And if you guys are ever, I'll make sure to mention this when I'm actually going to do it, in case anybody's in need of like a dose of comedy, because I've never played 16-inch before, so it should be quite hilarious.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. I was thinking about joining a softball league in Homewood this year, but I think I'll wait till next spring. 16-inch softball, it's so intense, like out in Mount Greenwood in Beverly, and I was going to play with my cousins one year, and I was just like, first of all, I was playing in the Score League too, and it was just too much of a time commitment. Mm-hmm. But those guys played a different level of intensity, and I'm just like, I just want to go and recreate.
I just want to go and drink beer, man. That's kind of what I'm going for. I'm sure you know Frank, the Hockey Night podcast maven, former Hockey Night podcast maven. He's actually the one who invited me to play for the team. So God knows that there will be plenty of malort and booze happening if I end up doing this. So
it's not malort, it's malort.
Why do I say malort, man?
Because you're a dork. It's not right.
Well,
it's malort.
Well, that goes without saying, man.
Did you see? I saw a video online last week of people from other countries trying malort.
Yes,
it was fantastic.
They always are.
Is wretched. Oh dear God! I was cracking up in the train like a weirdo.
Well, you fit I know right we got, in, oh, then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I know we've got some more hockey stuff to talk about, but you saw the Star Wars trailer, yes?
Yes, I did.
Your thoughts?
I'm not going to be any more excited for the movie than I am already. It was a really awesome trailer, and I think they nailed it. I'm very curious where they're going with this, man. Because Episode 7, like, the more you watch it, the more you realize it kind of really does rehash a lot of the stuff that happened in episodes 4 through 6. Like, it just kind of repackages it a little bit.
I think we're getting a total 180 here.
It seems like it. And that's, I think that's what really kind of stood out to the in the trailer. I really feel like this is going to go in a different direction now. And like you said, I really do. I'm very intrigued after seeing the trailer. I was already very excited for the movie. The trailer did nothing to dampen my enthusiasm.
There's a lot of red around this particular episode. If you notice, the Star Wars, I guess you'd call it like the silhouette logo, like the classic Star Wars logo, the first thing you see after a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. For the first time, it's a different color. It's usually yellow. It's red this time, and it's been red ever since they announced the name of the movie. And if you saw the poster today of Rey standing holding up the lightsaber like the original Star Wars poster with a split image of her and Luke, and that's all in red too. I think there's going to be a heel turn coming up here. I really do. I think either Luke is going to be evil or something's going to happen to Rey and she's going to become like an evil Jedi or something. But something ominous is happening, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I just hope that with Rey, it's nothing too crazy, just based on how little girls like your daughter have kind of identified with her.
You know what? I was thinking about that today. Like, man, if Rey becomes evil, how am I going to explain that to my daughter? I think that's pretty unlikely. I think you might see Luke turn a little evil, but who knows? I don't know. All right,
those Skywalker boys are just completely incapable of, you know, resisting the dark side, apparently.
Well, they're super inbred. When you think about it,
God.
Like, they all know each other. They're all cousins, and like, he's making out with his sister, and like, come on. They're space hillbillies. That's what the Skywalkers are. They're space hillbillies. It's all inmarrying and just gross. Just knock it off.
Like the tackle.
You have access to an entire galaxy and other races and total, different alien races. Go make out with them. Quit hooking up with your cousins, you weirdos. All right. Since we're not doing emails today, just because it's a special playoff edition, I want to tell you guys about the Black Oak, a great addition to the South Suburbs in Oaklawn, a full-service restaurant and tavern located at 9630 South Pulaski. They serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner with hours from 7 a.m. to 2 a.m. 7 days a week. They've got the awesome burgers with a blend of beef brisket, beef chuck, and short rib, and a steak sandwich made from Australian Wagyu sirloin. You will love every bite. They will be your Blackhawks playoff headquarters throughout, so make sure you stop by the Black Oak for a great meal and stay for the atmosphere as well. Contact them at 708-572-4500 or on Facebook at facebook.com/Black Oak Tavern. The Black Oak, the South Suburbs' finest casual upscale dining. So, I asked you if you're going to make any changes to the lineup. Let's wrap it up with our thoughts on that, and then we'll be back probably after game two or three with a new episode.
Yeah, I'm guessing we're going to be podcasting a lot, you know, based on the fact that our listeners have been so charitable and paying for all the equipment. And I love the picture you posted the other day on our Twitter account of the the computers and the mics and all that. And absolutely true that none of this would be possible without listeners. So, as always, we thank you guys for donating to our Patreon site and allowing us the opportunities to do those kinds of podcasts. And I have to say that podcast with Brian and with Scott, I thought was probably one of our best, if not our best ever. So
it was great, and it was a lot of fun to make too, and it sounded outstanding. And again, that's all because we're able to set up this equipment in a conference room in an office, and it has studio quality to it. So you guys have bought us a portable studio. We couldn't be more thankful. And if you want to help us out, patreon.com/madhousepod.
And now we will get into the hockey that you have donated money to hear. So I think that for me, the Blackhawks line changes, I think their defensive pairings worked for the most part. I would keep those intact, honestly. I wouldn't, you know, draw in Forsling or Kempney. I think that's fine, the six that they have right now. I would say the one thing I'm intrigued by would be potentially putting Dennis Rasmussen into the lineup over Jordan Tutu. That, not to say Jordan Tutu played poorly. I don't think he did. I think the only thing I'd be curious about is, I think with Rasmussen, you give your lineup a little bit more versatility if Joel Quenneville wants to continue like the experiments of guys like Tanner Caro getting bumped up. And it gives you just another guy that you can plug in on either the penalty kill or if you need a center on the bottom six or whatever. I'd be curious to see if maybe he wants to make like kind of an adjustment like that, especially if he's going to bump Ryan Hartman or John Hayden up in the lineup. I feel like adding a guy like Rasmussen with the versatility that he has, I think, might be a good idea.
I like that idea very much. And I thought Jordan Tutu was one of the few Hawks in the first period that did a damn thing at all. But then from there on out, he became pretty much a non-factor, as expected. Rasmussen has shown a lot this year, and I don't know what's happened over the last month and a half to get him in Q's doghouse, but I really like the development I saw from him this year. And again, a guy that can play center, play wing, play PK, play power play, anything you need from Dennis Rasmussen, you get. So I'd welcome him back in the lineup. As for the D pairings, I've seen enough of Seabrook and Oduya. I'm sorry, man. I get it. You want to have that top shutdown pair, but then your bottom four are just left floundering. And we know Seabrook has regressed. We've talked about it for 2 years now. Johnny Oduya is not the same guy he was here in 2015. I don't like those two together. I want Keith and Seabrook back, and I want Jalmerson and Oduya back. And Quenneville always talks about balance. He always talks about balance among his lines. He should have it among his pairs, too, and right now he doesn't have it.
Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that he's not wanting Nick Jalmerson to have to readjust to playing the left point again? Because he has said that he prefers, if he's going to be playing on a side, he wants to stay on that side.
Yeah, that could be part of it. It's the playoffs, man, and sometimes you got to do some things you're uncomfortable with, and they've had success with him there before. I know it's not his ideal. I know it's not what he wants to do, but if it means another Stanley Cup, I think, you know, and of course it's not that simple, but I think it's something they should consider, because Seabrook and Oduya is just not working. It's just not. And I don't know if putting Seabrook with Campbell is going to make it any better, or I don't know how else you mix it up aside from uniting Seabrook and Keith. It seems like this is what Q's got. This is what he's going to go with. Okay, it's fine. I think they can still win with it. That pairing has become a bit of a detriment. They were killed in possession yesterday.
Yeah, they really were.
I mean, let's see. Brent Seabrook was 56, of course. Yeah, I think I'm wrong about this. Yeah, 55 for Oduya, but I'm looking at the relative to the team, and he was 13% below relative that Seabrook and 15% below for Oduya. So
yep.
I think that's maybe just because the team was so high overall that number can be misleading.
Okay, yeah, Keith and Jalmerson were comical how high their Corsi was yesterday.
Yeah, let's see. Keith was a 70. Oh, my God.
70, like in the
79,
70s. Yeah.
Corsi 4 percentage. 23-6, chances for and against.
That's bonkers.
Jalmerson 21-5. That's 80% Corsi. Almost
81%. For the pairing that's supposed to be your shutdown pairing, to do that is insane to me.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. So there were, let's see, how many guys were below 50? We've got Nick Schmaltz was a 30.
He was a
4 chances, 4, 9 against. Jordan Tutu was 5, 4, 6 against for 45%. And I think the only other one is John Hayden. Yeah, he was 3, 4, 6 against. That's 33%. So, aside from that, everyone was well over 50% with Nicholas Jalmerson at a ridiculous 81% Corsi last night.
I can't believe
that. So when you start to panic about the series, take a look at that, and I think you're going to feel a little bit better.
Again, if Nashville wants to continue playing that conservative style of hockey that they played in Game 1, the Blackhawks will take that every day, because I think that benefits them to no end, being able to just attack and attack and attack and not have to worry about Nashville showing the kind of counterpunch that they've shown in the past. That did not look like regular season Nashville to me. That looked very different. That looked very odd. It was, I kind of don't blame the Blackhawks almost for getting off to such a slow start, because it was so difficult. It was like jarring. It was like, wait a minute, what team am I watching right now?
Well, hopefully Game 2 is a little more entertaining, a little more fast-paced, and the Blackhawks come out on top, because if they get down 2-0, of course, if there's any team that can come back down 2-0 or 3-0, it's the Hawks. But against a stifling defensive team like Nashville, that's going to be really, really tough. So we'll keep an eye on it. Obviously, we'll be watching every minute of the game. Post-games, I will do my best to jump on Facebook Live like I did last night on the Score 670 The Score's Facebook page for about 20, 30 minutes. Take your questions there. Hopefully, as the playoffs go on, I'll get on the air at the Score a little bit. Maybe my partner will join me. It's a possibility.
I'm up at the tower every day, man. Just let Mitch know. I'll come on over. I'll yell about hockey with you with the good people of Chicago.
That would be great fun. But until we talk to you next time, James, can you do one Sunday night on Easter night?
I believe I can manage that, yeah.
All right. Well, we'll discuss off the air tomorrow and figure it out. But hopefully we'll have another podcast for you this weekend. But thanks for listening to this one, the Game 1 edition of the Madhouse Chicago Hockey Podcast. It has been brought to you by Triple Threat Sports. For all your team outfitting needs, call Chris at 708-478-6090. The Black Oak and Okolana, South Suburbs' finest casual upscale dining, and Marishka's in Crest Hill, family-owned and operated since 1933. Everybody have a great weekend. For those of you Catholics like me, have a wonderful Easter, and we will talk to you hopefully Sunday. Have a great weekend, everybody.